that the Muslim community is the least affected by the language problem. He was certainly a much relieved man when the then government brought in the Tamil Language Special Provisions Bill, which came to be enacted virtually conceding the disastrous sentimental folly of the original official language bill. In a sense, the government was atoning for its mistake, though somewhat belatedly. His persuasive arguments, I note, are always interspersed by very relevant quotations which lend weight to his points of view. In the course of his speech in the Senate, on this occasion, he quoted Prime Minister Nehru of India, who warned against the communalism of the majority, as reported in the Morning Times on 12 May 1958. I quote, "The communalism of the minority was dangerous, but it petered out sometime or the other. But the communalism of the majority is far more dangerous than the communalism of the minority, because it wears the garb of nationalism. We have this communalism ingrained in us, and it comes out quickly," so says Nehru. "At the slightest provocation, and even decent people began to behave like barbarians when this communalism is roused in them." The next quotation he relies on to further garnish his arguments on the Official Language Special Provisions Bill is even relevant to the present times. He quotes the then Indian Minister of Scientific Research and Culture, Humayun Kabir, on the subject of group identity at a seminar on national unity versus group isolation, as reported in the periodical Quest. I quote, "Minorities are generally more sensitive about the retention of their separate character. Majorities do not generally insist on such retention because they know that greater uniformity is likely to lead to the acceptance of their way of life by the minority rather than vice versa. This is one of the main reasons why religious minorities are so anxious to preserve their special traditions and characteristic culture, even at the cost of estranging the majority. The same fear is behind the passion exhibited in recent times over the question of the language of India. It is easy for the majority to press its own point of view under the guise of national interest and dismiss the fears of the minority as parochial. One may certainly argue that the larger national interests should always prevail over the interests of a section or a group. Unfortunately, however, the majority has often a tendency of identifying the national interest with its own interest. There need not be any dishonesty or hypocrisy in such identification, for it is a common human failing in India and elsewhere to regard one's own point of view." On Tamil language and Muslims, Mr. Aziz stated, "We are now being called upon by the federalists to solve the problem by accepting the new and novel theory of the existence of the so-called Tamil-speaking nation in Ceylon. Quite a different concept from the Tamil-speaking peoples of Ceylon. This theory of the Tamil-speaking nation is historically inaccurate and politically mischievous. It is historically inaccurate because there are at least two distinct Ceylonese communities whose language is Tamil, and they are the Tamils and Muslims. While language and citizenship unite these two communities, both of them minorities, religion and culture separate them. And let me point out that religion and culture, according to Dr. Aziz, culture associated with religion plays an important part, a much more important part in the life of the Muslim community than it does in the life of others. On Tamil as a medium of instruction in schools, he says. Tamil has to be recognized as a medium of instruction throughout the island because there are Tamil-speaking Muslims living scattered throughout the country. The federal solution is no solution to the Muslims who are Tamil-speaking and who inhabit South, Central and West Ceylon in addition to the North and the East. As a matter of fact, all the previous governments for many years have been establishing Tamil schools for the Muslim children in those areas, and there must be some provision made for them. Now, what would be the litmus test to measure the community's progress in the post-independence period? To my mind, if our middle class is disproportionately smaller than the share of Muslims in the total population, that would indicate regression. Reading Aziz and reflecting on his prophetic comments made in the 1950s and 1960s, one of the main obstacles to upward mobility in the South and Central Ceylon could be attributed to the decision by succeeding generations of parents to abandon educating their children in their mother tongue, at least up to the primary level, as strongly advocated by Dr. Aziz. I would dare say that lack of courage among succeeding generations of Muslim leaders to pointedly tackle this issue has virtually forced Tamil into the ghetto. This is more vividly noticed in the urban centers of the South. Take for instance, the catchment area of students around this, pardon me for saying this, erstwhile Center of Excellence of Muslim Education, Zahira College. The clamor to get our children into single medium schools has grown to inestimable proportions in the mistaken belief that it could ensure upward social mobility. The four citizenships of Amy Aziz was a brilliant exposition of the Muslim dilemma of the period of conflict and the post-conflict phase of our history. It is our conviction that we best serve Sri Lanka not by the abandonment of our culture but by its preservation and promotion, aiming at unity in diversity, political unity in the midst of cultural diversity. Quoting from a report of a prize distribution day at Zahira College, Colombo, he warmed to this theme of unity in diversity. We are not unmindful of the value of political unity. We believe that Sir Richard Livingstone, that men are born to four citizenships. They should be able to live as good members of their family, of their community, of their nation, and of the whole human society. And that many of the world's troubles can be traced to a failure in one or the other of these citizenships. To our never mastering the area of living with others in the family, in the community, in the nation, and in international relations, we also realize that these four citizenships must coexist and that the transgression of one of these loyalties must necessarily involve the transgression of the other three. While an Englishman in the United Kingdom or an American of Anglo-Saxon descent in the United States could exercise his rights and discharge his duties inherent in these four citizenships through the medium of one single language, namely English, and without the necessity of his having to acquire a knowledge of any other language, we the Muslims of Ceylon, associates Dr. Aziz, are in an entirely different, extremely difficult position. To fulfill adequately the obligations cast on us by these four citizenships, we should of necessity acquire a knowledge of four different languages with four different scripts. The four languages concerned being Tamil, Arabic, Sinhalese and English. Each of them with a different background of religion and history. In the case of Sinhalese Malay Muslims, the problem is further complicated by the presence of still another language, Bahasa Malayu. The far-sighted scholar statesman anticipated other Muslim leaders of Asia of recent times. If he did not refer to the age of fiber optics and the information highways of the interconnected world he did come very close to it. On the need to retain English as the language taught in schools, he had no hesitation to be brutally honest. He says, "My own sincere belief is that the total abandonment of English in Ceylon, or even the relegation of it to a minor place, is altogether undesirable. Our true interests demand bilingualism, with English as one of the languages." He pointed out in a lecture to the Royal Empire Society in 1951, "If English is going to be the medium at the university, English cannot be abandoned as a medium in secondary education." Reading the thoughts of Dr. Aziz expressed in 1951, we can understand why BPOs in the first decade of the 21st century are located in Bangalore and not in Colombo. English, of course, was the tongue of the colonial rulers. You may even concede that it was the language that was spoken by both master and slave. Many of the objections against English as the national, as the language of education and administration were valid in the colony. It was then an imposition. Amy Aziz was a universalist who had no inhibition to arrive at what he thought was correct in the best interest of independent Sri Lanka. This made him ask the rhetorical question: what is the place occupied by the English language in the world of today, and whether Ceylon can progress without English? Amy Aziz was the first Sri Lankan educationist who framed the question of the language of the departing British in the post-colonial psyche and our inability to come to terms with the realities of the global markets that emerged at the turn of the last century. With a remarkable premonition, Amy Aziz referred to the report of the Radhakrishnan Commission of India, which pointed out that English is not merely the language of the Englishman, but also the British Isles, the USA, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. It was taught as a second language in practically all European countries, including the then Soviet USSR, and was widely used in Asia. Dr. Mahathir Mohamad says, "We do not become European simply because we wear a coat and tie and speak English and practice democracy instead of feudalism. We have to learn the language of international communication and the language of telecommunications, of computers, of the internet. Learning in English language will reinforce the spirit of nationalism when it is used to bring about development and progress for the country. True nationalism means doing everything possible for the country, even if it means learning the English language." Consider the world as it is today. The number of speakers of English is estimated to be over 1 billion. According to Wikipedia, the top 10 English-speaking nations are India, 350 million. The United States of America, 251 million. The People's Republic of China, 250 million. The United Kingdom, 60 million. The Philippines, 43 million. Germany, 36 million. Canada, 25 million. Australia, 17 million. Pakistan, 17 million. And France, 16 million. These figures show that the so-called native English speakers are far outnumbered by those whom I would call Joe English speakers. Our failure to recognize the relevance of English that A.M.A. Aziz illustrated with such clarity of purpose has made English the exclusive preserve of the affluent. In the world of education that A.M.A. Aziz inhabited, the University of Cambridge was accessible from Vaitisra Vidyalayam and Jaffna Hindu College. English was taught in colonial Ceylon. In the post-colonial context, after six decades of independence, the greatest tribute we can pay him today may be our reluctant admission that English in post-colonial Sri Lanka is a tool of neo-colonial linguistic imperialism. Why do I say so? I say so because we have failed to domesticate English. It still retains the aura of privilege. It is not so in many other former British colonies. The process of domesticating English demands that the post-colonial practitioners adapt the language in the same manner that English has been shaped and sculpted to fit the environment it has been transplanted in as the first language in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and as a second language in India, Bangladesh, Malaysia, Singapore, Philippines, and other commonwealth countries. What about the future? The visionary educationist in whose honor we are assembled here in this institution, he once said on, he says, there should be, at the earliest opportunity, one examination where the English medium will be enforced in respect of certain subjects and the Sinhalese or Tamil medium in respect of the rest of the subjects. By this method alone could we ensure equality of educational opportunity, both to the city pupil as well as to the pupil from backward areas. The claims of English, so necessary on utilitarian grounds, could thus be harmonized with the claims of Sinhalese or Tamil, which is so essential on national grounds. For these reasons, bilingualism should become an essential feature of the new society of Ceylon, where every member will know English in addition to his national language, namely Sinhala or Tamil. He goes on to say further, at this stage, we shall have to ask ourselves the question, what is meant by bilingualism? What is the kind of knowledge of English that is required of every individual? And whether those who are not seeking higher education should be required to possess this knowledge of English? Here again, he provides an answer that seems to be more relevant to this day than in 1956. He is insistent that bilingualism is not equilingualism. A bilingualism that is good enough for a salesman is hardly sufficient for a teacher. He need not possess the ability to speak the second language fluently. In the second stage, he'll be required, in addition, to converse intelligibly and fairly fluently in the second language. The accent required, in addition, to converse intelligibly and fairly fluently in the second language. Here, the second language begins to be an opportunity and new vistas are opened up and the life of the individual enriched. In the third stage, he will possess, in addition to the ability to write the second language correctly, he need not, in writing the second language, reach the height of literary excellence, but whatever he writes must be free from grammatical and spelling errors and without gross violation of idiom. In the fourth stage, he should, in addition, possess the correct and convincing power of expression, both in writing and speaking, the two languages. In the fifth stage, he commands a greater facility and power in the use of both languages than 90% of the people who use either of these languages as their mother tongue. In the sixth stage, he will possess the unapproachable ideal of 100% perfection in both languages. A.M.A. Aziz never cringed in resolving the eternal Muslim dilemma. He says, the views of the Muslims may not be quite pleasant, either to the Sinhalese or to the Tamils, but I am sure they will appreciate that by virtue of our history, by virtue of our geographical distribution, by virtue of the basis on which our community is built, and by virtue of the fact that we have been a minority community from the very beginning, and we have been a minority community for the last 450 or 500 years, not only from the point of view of numbers, but also from the point of view of influence, we are bound to take a slightly different view from the other minorities or the larger minority community. Amy Aziz was explicit in his declaration that as Muslims we have a distinctive view. Please bear with me and allow me to recall some great pearls of wisdom given to us by Maulana Abul Kalam Azad here, who was the first Minister of Education of independent India. I quote, "It was India's historic destiny that many human races, cultures and religions should flow to her, and that many a caravan should rest here. One of the last of these caravans was that of the followers of Islam. This came here and settled for good. In India, everything bears the stamp of the joint endeavors of the Hindus and Muslims. Our languages were different, but we grew to use the common language. Our manners and customs were dissimilar, but they produced a new synthesis. No fantasy or artificial scheming to separate and divide us can break this unity. On this note, I wish to conclude by saying that our great educationist and humanist Amy Aziz lived out those words of the same essential humanism. He was the synthesis of the many caravans that reached our island. For him, the modernity and the new sciences of his age and the cultural diversity of his environs provided a rich canvas for him to paint his inherited glorious Islamic traditions. To him, the word of God was clear. Those who seek knowledge are the inheritors of the Prophet. Thank you.